I'll stop there. Look at the last of the three Beatitudes and then move a little bit more into Matthew. The beautiful quality of the poor in spirit, they are those who suffer with the suffering, those who are meek, those who hunger for justice. Well, another quality is the merciful. And Jesus says, the merciful will obtain mercy. Now, the word mercy is very rich. Any sisters of mercy here? The mercy is a very rich concept. It translates the Greek word eleos, which we find in the Mass, Kyrie, Lord, eleison, have mercy on us, eleos, eleison. So, eleos is the word in Greek in the New Testament, but that word, in the tradition of the Bible, that is in the Septuagint, the Old Testament Greek rendition of the Hebrew Bible, there are three quite distinct but related concepts in Hebrew, all focused on this one word, eleos, or mercy. And they are the word chesed, which is chesed v'emet, is a common expression for God, and chesed v'emet, lover and faithful, covenant love and fidelity. In fact, that's behind the New Testament, John's Gospel, when Jesus is full of grace and truth. Grace and truth sound very academic. Full of chesed v'emet, full of faithful covenant love. Chesed means a love that is covenanted, a love that is committed and will never be taken back. A promised love, a love that's offered irrevocably. That's chesed. That's part of what mercy is. It also takes in the word hanan, which means the normal word for grace, favor, gift. Yohanan, which is our John. Yohanan means Yahweh, Yohanan. God is gracious. God is the giver. And a third concept or word that's contained in eleos and in mercy is the word raham, which comes from the Hebrew word rehem, which means the womb of a woman. And raham is that feeling that a mother has for the child in her womb. So this brings us into the body, into feelings, into what all you understand that to be, that something that's not so much in the mind or the heart, but right in the middle of our body kind of feelings. So it's feeling, tender feelings, you might translate it. Promised love, faithfully promised love, favour or grace, and feelings of compassion, all held in the word mercy. Well, blessed are you if you have those attitudes to people, because you will find, says Jesus, you are open to receive those same things from God. If I'm not compassionate to you, you can bet your life I don't think God is compassionate to me. Because if I knew God was compassionate to me, I couldn't but be compassionate to you. We're like that, aren't we? Only when we're open to loving can we receive love. And so, just some examples from Jesus' life. Chapter 9, verse 36, when Jesus saw the crowds, he had compassion for them. They were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. When Jesus went ashore, we're told later, he saw a great crowd and he had compassion for them, felt for them, and he cured their sick. Jesus called his disciples to him and said, I have compassion for the crowd, because they have been with me now for 3 days and have nothing to eat, and I don't want to send them away hungry. They might faint on the way. Jesus, feeling for them. Moved with compassion, we're told, Jesus touched the eyes of the blind men, and immediately they regained sight. So We just have to watch Jesus all the way through the gospel being merciful. And when we catch the quality by watching him, learning to be like him, and that opens us up to the mercy of God. The fifth quality, the pure in heart. The poor in spirit are pure in heart. Blessed are the pure in heart. Now here comes a wonderful promise. The pure in heart will see God, is the beatitude. See God in children, see God in each other, see God in the world, see God in themselves. Purity of heart is needed for that, though. And ultimately, see God in face to face in heaven. Let's read a couple of the Old Testament texts for you that pick up something of this feeling. Psalm 24, verse 3. Who shall ascend the hill of the Lord? Who shall stand in his holy place? Those who have clean hands and pure hearts, who do not lift up their souls to what is false and do not swear deceitfully. They will receive blessing from the Lord and vindication from the God of their salvation. Such is the company of those who seek him, who seek the face of the God of Jacob. Those of pure hearts seek the face of the God of Jacob. But we can't do this for ourselves. I can't purify my heart. You can't purify yours. It's worth pointing out the word pure. If you look at it, P-U-R-E is exactly the same word in English as the word fire. F-I-R-E. It's the same root. Purify means fire. Burn away whatever is dross or distraction from what's left is the gold. So we pray in Psalm 51, verse 10, create in me a clean heart, a pure heart, O God. Put a new and right spirit in me. And Ezekiel, half quoted this earlier, Ezekiel 36, I will sprinkle pure water on you. I, God, says, and you shall be purified from all that defiles you. A new heart I will give you. A new spirit I will put in within you. And I'll remove from your body the heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. And that promise, blessed are the pure in heart, those who are willing to have their heart fired and hurt and purified and opened and like the seed pod, you know, in the heat, it opens up and the seed is planted, but the pod has to break first to spray the seed. So our hearts often have to break, like Jesus on the cross, so that our love can flow forth. It releases love, finally. Well, Paul holds out the same promise. He says, now we see in a mirror dimly. And please, the mirrors of his day were not the mirrors of our day, where you can see quite clearly. With the mercury, is it on the back, or whatever, the silver on the back, and then the glass. Their mirrors were made of bronze, and you can get a very general reflection in them. So, we see in a mirror dimly, says Paul, but then we'll see face to face. Now I know only in part, then I will know fully, even as I am known. Finally, another last quality of the Beatitudes. Blessed are those who make peace. They will be called, literally, sons of God. Translated children, if you like, a lot of the new translations do. But the problem with the word children of God is that it misses an essential element of this text. Child of God is a relating with God as a woman or a man, a daughter or son of God. That's a concept. But sons of God in the New Testament doesn't only relate us to God, it relates us to Jesus the Son. So it carries with it a nuance which is essential to it. You will be made sons of God, meaning you will be identified with Jesus the Son. I live no longer I, but Christ lives in me, whether you be woman or man. The word peace doesn't occur very often in Matthew, in fact only twice more in chapter 10. And they don't add a lot to its meaning. The key image of peace that I'm aware of, it's the Hebrew word shalom, which is the greeting of in Jewish world still, salam in Arabic, shalom in Hebrew, and it means harmony. It means may everything about you be full and blooming and flourishing. A beauty image is that of a chorus, of an orchestra rather, or a chorus, but an orchestra in which every instrument is different and every instrument is playing its note, perhaps a different note from the others, certainly a different sound, but every instrument is beautifully sensitive to the other instruments so that you end up with a shalom, a resolution of sound that is perfectly harmonious. Peaceful parish is one where everyone is living to the full, offering their gifts, but sensitive to everyone else. So that peace that Jesus came to give, as he says, it requires division, it requires choice. It's not peace and quiet, it's peace from decisions having been made. And so he says, don't think I came to bring peace, inverted commas, to earth. I didn't. I came to bring a sword. In other words, I'm not here to bring the kind of peace you might like, where nothing matters, nobody cares, everything's equal, you're okay, I'm okay, and we can just do what we like. It's the peace that comes from vigorous searching for truth, argument, thrust and parry in love, and a determination to find the truth. But in that truth, we will rise to a higher viewpoint together, a resolution of argument, not a failure to involve ourselves in anything. It's one of the gifts of the Spirit, Galatians 5:22. The fruit of the Spirit of Jesus is love, joy, peace, and other qualities that are mentioned. A peace that Jesus made through his blood on the cross. So that brings us to a conclusion of those first few verses. I'll just take you for a brief period now into a little bit more of Matthew chapter 5. After that, you'd have to say constructed by Matthew, brought together a lot of the themes of Jesus' teaching. There's quite a deliberate shift now in verse 11. We've just read, the last one was, blessed are those who, third person, are persecuted in the cause of justice. The kingdom of heaven is theirs. That's verse 10. Verse 11 says, blessed are you. When the second person singular, it's come out of another world. Blessed are you, now we're very direct, when people revile you, and persecute you, and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely because of me. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, in the same way they persecuted the prophets before you. So here we're looking straight away, where the whole sermon is about discipleship. We've looked at the main principles. Now we're looking at various aspects of being a disciple of Jesus. And the first one Matthew looks at is our relationship to the world. You'd expect that of a missionary gospel. So it's our relationship to the world. And the first thing he's saying is, no, you're going to get hurt too. You better get that right from the beginning. It's not going to be an easy mission. You're not going to be always accepted any more than Jesus was. And notice the difference here in that verse. In the Beatitudes, it said, persecuted on account of justice or righteousness. Here it's persecuted because of me, Jesus. It is righteousness, but it's relationship with Jesus that gets the accent here, this intimacy with him. If Jesus is crucified, we'll be crucified in different ways if we join him. But he says, you're still blessed in that situation. And he asks us to rejoice. Teresa of Avila, just to take one example of someone who knows a lot about all this, you know, she talks about suffering, as everyone must, if they're going to look at life in its fullness. And she talks rather beautifully, I reckon, about embracing the cross. And that's hard, isn't it? Or perhaps it's hard for us to get to that point. But embracing the cross is clearly the only way, not the cross, but Jesus on it. So suffering where we finally embrace the suffering, that's a long way towards being poor in spirit or a disciple. But then she goes a step further. I've got some insights into embracing the cross, I must say, just to be honest with you. But the next one, I can only sniff it at a mile away, you know. Like you read some of the saints, they are actually... We had a beautiful brother who's still alive with us, one of our MSC brothers. I had a good yarn with him one day, and he knows how to do this, but I was trying to ask him how to do it, and he explained it to me, but I can't. You've got to grow up a bit yet. It was being joyful with the cross. Actually rejoicing in it. Wow, that's really something, I imagine. Not only embrace it, but rejoice in it. Not because it's suffering, but because of the joy that of sharing the suffering with Jesus. It's something like that. It's the joy of being privileged to be with him standing at the cross or suffering there. And that joy can only come with a lot of love and a lot of awareness of the Beatitudes. Well, that's what this is here saying. Look, rejoice in this because your reward will be great because of the intimacy of being in communion with Jesus in his suffering. On that, if you can, Colossians 1:24, Paul says, writing from prison, I am now rejoicing in my sufferings for your sake. And in my flesh I am completing what is lacking in Christ's affliction for the sake of his body, the church. Somehow Paul saw himself as being part of the redemptive action. And just as we are helped when we see someone suffering with love, because it helps us see love even in a suffering situation, might assist us. So we watch Jesus on the cross and we watch each other on the cross. And if someone can be on a cross and be as loving as Jesus, it's very helpful, isn't it? And extraordinarily redemptive. And Paul sees himself there. Peter, first letter of Peter, chapter 1. Although you haven't seen him, Jesus, you love him. And even though you don't see him now, you believe in him and rejoice with an indescribable and glorious joy, for you're receiving the outcome of your faith, the salvation of your souls. Beautiful word, soul. It means your inner longing being is being saved. Behind your psyche and your heart is the soul. Again, chapter 4 of the same letter of Peter. Rejoice, he says, insofar as you are sharing Christ's sufferings, so that you may also be glad and shout for joy when his glory is revealed. If you are reviled for the name of Christ, you are blessed. Because the Spirit of glory, the Spirit of God, is resting on you. We're not alone in it. Practically, at the beginning of this sermon, stated quite clearly that it will bring suffering, so that we know. Still talking about our relationship with the world, there are two beautiful images which are quite simple. I'll deal with them quickly. You, says Jesus to these disciples on the mountain, to us if we wish, you are the salt of the earth. Salt was used to give taste, spice. Before refrigeration, it was necessary to preserve, as you know. It was used in the sacrifices, the covenant of salt. It was one of the big trading things in the ancient world, salt tax, right back to Roman and pre-Roman times. So it was a very important refrigeration, or whatever the word is, element. So it was used here in the sacrifices to a covenant of salt with God in exchange. So you're the salt of the earth. You're the ones that have got to give it bite and preserve it and give it energy and taste. So if salt loses its taste, says Jesus, well, what the heck's the good of it? Can its saltiness be restored? It's no longer good for anything but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You're the light of the world, he said. The world's in darkness. It needs you to see what love is, who God is, to see incarnate in us. So you're the light of the world. A city built on a mountain can't be hid. No one, after lighting a lamp, puts it under a bushel, but they put it on a lampstand, that's where it's supposed to be, to give light to all in the house. So in the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works, critically important, and give the glory to your Father in heaven. We're used to calling God Father. This is the first time it appears in Matthew's Gospel. And it'll occur, I've forgotten, 78 or something times. It's very common. Here's the first occurrence in our Gospel. God is called Father, Abba. When they see your good works, it will be quite apparent to them that it's not you, and we're not doing it to siphon off glory for ourselves. That's the danger, and that's the awful temptation. But it'll be apparent to everyone looking at us, as it was when they looked at Jesus, that there was something more to this, that there was something of God here, and they will be attracted by you or me or a disciple to look to the mystery of God and see God revealed in us, and therefore be taken into communion with God, not into communion with us. Favourite theme, one of his favourite themes, that the new law, the new Torah, is a fulfilment of the old and does not do away with it. On the contrary, it brings it to its full flowering. It fulfills the Old Testament. So, verse 17 of chapter 5, don't think I've come to abolish the Torah, the law, or the prophets. No, I haven't come to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I tell you, till heaven and earth pass away, not one letter, not one stroke of a letter. Hebrew's got these little tiny strokes, as every language does. So not even the tiniest little bit, comma, or stroke of a letter, not one will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Now, to accomplish doesn't mean to keep it the same or to just continue it. It means to fulfill it, bring it to fulfillment, and transcend it. Take it like a flower transcends the bush. It's not another leaf, it's a flower. But it comes out of the bush. Jesus is the flowering of Israel. Therefore, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness, and this verse dominates the whole next chapter, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you'll never enter the kingdom of heaven. It has to be something far deeper, far more internal than the external observance of the Torah, which was sadly a common feature among the religious leaders of Jesus' day. So now, and we'll just go a little bit into it, having said that, Matthew now goes through the commandments, the Torah, the Ten Commandments, the ones applying to us, and compares the Torah with the new Torah of Jesus. Firstly, the fifth commandment, which you remember is, you shall not kill. Well, let's see what Christianity has to say about that commandment. You've heard that it was said to those of ancient times, you shall not murder. Exodus chapter 20, verse 13, that is. And whoever murders shall be liable to judgment. But I say to you, this is Jesus, this is the new law giver. This is God incarnate saying, if you're angry with a brother or sister, you'll be liable to judgment. Murdering them in your heart. If you insult a brother or sister, you'll be liable to the council. If you say you're a fool and just dismiss them, you'll be liable to the hell of fire. Now, there's not meant to be a crescendo there particularly. It's three ways of saying the same thing. It's just trying to get in here and say, look, it's terrible what you can do to others with your heart. You must purify the heart, not just worry about external murder. This has to be pure. And in fact, if it's not, if your relationships to your brothers or sisters, if you do any of those things, sit in judgment on them, dismiss them, talk about them behind their back, muck up their character, reckon they're hopeless, or whatever we might do to other people whom God has made, then what happens in here? We actually destroy ourselves. And that's what hellfire is. It's Gehenna. It's the city, it's the valley at the south of Jerusalem, where the bodies of those who went through the plague of the first and the siege of Jerusalem in the first experience of that back in 587, and all the bodies that died of hunger, they were all taken into that valley and just burnt. And it became a terrible symbol of a city that self-destructed because it had no wisdom and no obedience and didn't listen to God. At least that's the way it was interpreted, and that's partly right, by Jeremiah and so on. So they saw that forever, that valley, as a symbol of self-destruction that comes when our heart is not open to God. And that's what Jesus says he'll do, if we're murdering people inside, assassinating their character or whatever. So, says Jesus, typical of the Old Testament, when you're offering your gift at the altar, relating to God now, if you remember that your brother or sister has something against you, then leave your gift there on the altar and go and first be reconciled to your brother and sister, then come back and offer your gift. There's problems with that which you can see as quickly as I can, and I'm sure Jesus could, that you cannot reconcile on your own. So if you and I have a disagreement, I can't reconcile that disagreement. I can be willing to, but reconciliation only happens if you also are willing. So we're not asked to reconcile first. We're asked to be willing to reconcile. And if the other person won't, for whatever reason, we have to bear that pain, and of course we can come back to the altar, having attempted reconciliation or shown we're willing to do it, and being open to it if the other person changes. Then Jesus used a little story just from his own world. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you're on the way to the court with him, he says. Or your accuser may hand you over to the judge and the judge to the guard, and you'll be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you won't get out till you've paid the last penny. So don't wait till the end to sort all this out. Try and do it quickly. Try and let not the sun come down upon your anger. Try to be open to reconciliation early. How typical that statement of Jesus is of the Old Testament as well. Here's Isaiah chapter 1, verse 10, about taking our gift to the altar. The Old Testament and the New will not accept cult as a substitute for justice, because God is the lover of the poor. And if we're not concerned with that, then the God we're serving is an idol. The multitude of your sacrifices, says Isaiah, what are they to me? I have more than enough of burnt offerings of rams and the fat of fattened animals. When you come to appear before me, who asked this of you, this trampling on my courts? Stop bringing meaningless offerings. Your incense is detestable to me. New moons, Sabbaths, convocations, I can't bear your evil assemblies, says God. They've become a burden to me. When you spread out your hands in prayer, I'll hide my eyes from you. I won't listen because your hands are full of blood. Wash and make yourselves clean. Take your evil deeds out of my sight. Stop doing wrong. Learn to do right. Seek justice. Help the oppressed. Defend the cause of the fatherless. Plead the case of the widow. And Jesus asks us in this new law to have our hearts so pured that we will recognize the beauty of another and not be a cause of any harm to them by our attitude, our word, our feelings, our harshness, that we will take on the heart of God in regard to everyone. And now when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain. And after he sat down, his disciples came to him and he began to speak and he taught them, saying, and we'll come back to that. The crowds are there, the mountain is there, and the disciples are those from the crowd who come to Jesus and listen to his words. Anyone can come. Those who don't come remain the crowd. Those who do are the disciples, to actually personally listen to him. And that's quite dramatic. And that's we're now in the setting of the Sermon on the Mount. The crowds appear in the very last verse of the sermon, chapter 7, verse 28 to 29. At the end of the sermon, we come back to that. When Jesus had finished saying these things, which we'll look at later, the crowds were astounded at his teaching, and he taught them as one having authority, not as their scribes. So clearly Matthew wants us to understand the teaching that comes is there for everybody, for the crowds. And the crowds are astonished by it. So he doesn't let us forget that this is not a little coterie of people listening here. It's for the world. In fact, it's for everybody. However, there is a special group that are coming close to him to really listen, heed, and follow him. And they're the ones we call disciples. And this particular sermon, the first of the five large sermons, no doubt based on the Pentateuch, the five scrolls of the law, in this new law, the first one is about, okay, what does it mean to be a disciple? And that's what we'll start looking at in a moment. The mountain that we're looking at is Mount Sinai. I mean, it is the Mount of Beatitudes, which is a hill or something, presumably. But this is symbolic language here. We're meant to imagine Moses on the mountain of Sinai receiving the law and bringing the law down to the crowds on the two tablets of stone. Jesus is on the mountain, the new Moses, bringing the new Torah to the whole world. The quotation from Exodus, the Lord said to Moses, "Come up to me on the mountain. Wait there and I'll give you the tablets of stone with the law and the commandment which I've written for their instruction." Isaiah chapter 57, is it how beautiful on the mountain are the feet of those who bring the good news, who say your God reigns. Here is Jesus bringing good news on the mountain to the whole world, and we've got to pray at the beginning of it that we're willing to listen and learn and want to be what Jesus is telling us we are to be. And for the rest of this first meditation, we'll be reflecting on the Beatitudes. So these are Jesus' words. I'll just read them through simply and then start going through them slowly with you. Blessed are the poor in spirit. And before we move on, let's look at the word blessed, because it comes in every one of these. Blessed is the English, of course. The Greek is a makarios, and I only say that because makarios is a very common Greek name still. And a lot of the Greek patriarchs are makarios. You'll often hear it as a name. And it comes from the Hebrew, the original Hebrew expression is of no value particularly, I'll just say it, is ashrei, and it often appears in the Psalms and the Old Testament in Beatitudes. Blessed is the one whose hands are free of guilt. Ashrei, Greek makarios. So it's a common enough expression. What it means is really important. It's sometimes translated happy. Happy are the poor in spirit. You've no doubt heard that. That's pretty good, really. But the problem with the word happy is that it doesn't contain in it the basis for any happiness. And the word itself, if we're going to be really strict in language, happy, H-A-P-P-Y, I say that not because I don't think you can spell, but because it's the same root as happen, H-A-P-P-E-N, or haphazard, hap. Something that happens to be there by chance, by luck, by fortune. So when you're happy, a lot of that's luck. What did you eat for tea tonight? Could affect your happiness. Someone's letter that they happened to write to you today. Or just the vagaries of moods and male hormones. I suppose women have them too, do you? So you've got happiness is really not a deep word. It's a beautiful thing to be happy, but it's chancy. This is not about that. The word blessed is good, but it doesn't quite capture what the word means. Blessed means blessed by God, which gets us to the source. It's something that God does in blessing us with grace. So blessed is a bliss, B-L-I-S-S, it's the same word as blessed. So it's a bliss thing, it's coming from God. That's good, but if we had an English word, I'd give it to you, but we haven't got it. What the ashrei or makarios means is joyful, but in a joy that you could have on a cross, like Jesus. So we're not talking about happiness. A joy that's really profound, that is a gift from God, and is known to be a blessing. The joy of doing God's will, the joy of being in communion with God, the joy of faith, of trust, even in terrible circumstances. So that's what we're talking about here. If you like, a happiness that comes from being blessed and allowing the blessing to permeate your being. Well, who are blessed? Who have this bliss? Who experience this profound but faith experience of joy? Who does it? Well, here's the list. And I want you to notice the first and last ones stand out. They are really the key ones, and I'm going to do them first, actually. The first and the eighth. Then there are six in the middle, which have a different focus, and they are really subdivisions of the first. The last or eighth one is a qualification of it. So I want to look with you at the first and last one, which are in the present tense, and I'll just read them as they are. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Is the kingdom. Now, present tense. The kingdom of heaven is at hand, he said a moment ago. Here it is for those who are blessed and accept the blessing, namely, the poor in spirit. That's our key concept. Look at the last one, verse 10. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness. Because they're doing what's right. Not for other reasons, but precisely because of that. Because they're doing God's will. They are persecuted. Blessed are you, are those, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Same phrase. That's